You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back to part two of You Can't Say That. I'm Tanya Pinkins, and I'm speaking with playwright, television writer, Keith Joseph Atkins. So let's talk about your playwriting.
Okay.
The plays that I've seen probably three or four of your plays, and I almost got to be in one, but, you know, Central Park, you've got a play about the creation of Central Park. Would you want to tell us about?
Yeah. That play, The People Before the Park, which is supposed to have a production in the fall. Haven't heard from the theater yet. But it's a play that was inspired by Seneca Village, which was a black community, 19th century black community in the central, what we now know as Central Park, around 81st, 86th Street, sort of Central Park West, going east to maybe what now would be considered 6th Avenue, right? Mm-hmm. And it was a black community that was sort of governed by the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, as well as the African Union Church. And so many of the sort of residents were members of those two churches, right? And then even prior to Seneca Village, which I believe was sort of founded in 1825, I believe, 1825 or 1826, there was another community called York Hill, which was about like a block or two northeast of what they consider Seneca Village. It was another community there that was predominantly African Union, right? And so, and that community was around since the late 1700s. It's because, as far as documentation, and the reason why we know that was because there was a fugitive enslaved black man who fled to Canada, and once he got to Canada, like I think in the early 1800s, late 1700s, he wrote that he had for a while sort of hid in York Hill, which we now know is the Central Park area. So I just believe that once York Hill was sort of dismantled because the city decided to put the water tower in that area and just sort of disperse those people, they just went a little west and purchased land from some white people who they already knew. So it wasn't like suddenly people came out of nowhere and created Seneca Village. They were already in that area. And so I was just very, very, like I am always very interested in sort of unpacking and looking at the black experience historically and future-wise, but in this case, historically, and how people navigate and sort of like the audacity of black people, the intelligence, the strategic moves of black people. And so with Seneca Village, you have this community that came together who wanted to stay together to keep themselves sort of isolated from downtown Manhattan, which was basically the Wild West, where they would walk the streets downtown Manhattan, five points, and other places like that, and can be murdered in a moment just for being black. So being uptown was safe for them. It was a safe haven. It was swampy. It was wooded for the most part, very, very rocky. Wasn't easy to sort of till the land there, but at least it was theirs. And they were also property owners, partly because in order to vote in the city of New York, in the state of New York, you had to have property. So, so many black people were being impacted by white policy and being powerless in those policies. They decided, like, let's even take a stronger step forward and, you know, make sure we're voting on behalf of ourselves. So we need to own some land. And so many of the owners of the properties in Seneca Village, and even, you know, earlier with York Hill, but now just with Seneca Village, were members of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, some of whom didn't even live in Seneca Village. They just owned the property there so they could vote.
That's a piece of history that I did not know. Now, you brought up two things. It took me on two tangents. I got to hold both of them. Okay. The first one I want to hit is that, did you ever see that show, The Nick?
I have not seen The Nick yet. No, it's on my list of many.
Well, it was interesting because one of the things I appreciated about The Nick was it seemed to depict the violence that happened against black Americans in New York in a way that I felt was authentic and was showing that this was not okay.
Right.
And I'm going to contest that with that. I watched the first episode of The Watchmen, and I felt that one, when I turned in and I saw that violence, I felt like they were not commenting. They were just showing it as if this was okay and this was fine. And that was so different than the way it was framed inside the Nick, even though in both instances, no words were spoken.
Right.
There was a sense in the Nick that you knew, like, this is not cool.
Right. Right.
You also have a history in finding people's African heritage.
African heritage. More specifically, their Black American and African American ancestry or genealogy.
How do you do that? Because I've done Ancestry.com. I've done the National Geographic, the Human Genome Project.
Okay, right.
And that stuff doesn't seem very accurate at all. It's like sort of isolating you by a community. And we know that two Yorubas have more diverse DNA than any two people anywhere on the planet once we leave the continent. So tell me more deeply about this tracking people's ancestry.
Yeah, I mean, for me, what I do is I build family genealogies and family trees. I'm not in the business of DNA testing or anything like that. So I can't help anyone find out any specific ethnic group they come from within Africa at all, like any kind of scientific thing. But I am able to build trees for, I've had at least 50 clients, 50 Black families that I've built trees and built genealogies for over the last decade. So the origin story of all that is my maternal grandfather told me his family genealogy when I was a kid, and I had no idea. He kept telling me this person, their name and their mother and their father. And I was like the only one of the grandkids who was sort of spouting what he had told me. And I felt a little bit like a nerd. I didn't know why he had told me whatever. And as an adult, I was like, wow, I want to know more about what he sort of instilled in me. And then I just started doing research. I went to the Mormon Genealogical Library, discovered they had all this documentation because the Mormons believe, I think they want to gather as many ancestors or many people as possible in the hereafter. There's some kind of religious sort of mission around their genealogy. It's not just they're just looking for their family. It's like some kind of heavenly, to be with the Heavenly Father, the more people you can gather in your family, like the better or something like that. I could be sort of not languaging that correctly, but I know there is a religious sort of element to their genealogy, but their libraries are packed with information. And so I was able to find my grandfather's family as well as my grandmother's family. And because of that, I just expanded all four grandparents. And I found documentations and wedding certificates and death certificates and births and migratory information and lynching information. It was just packed with information, right? And so I did that for myself, and then I started doing it for others. And then I did so many families that I began to have a sense of, if you said a last name, I could tell you what part of the country that Black family came from. And so sometimes people will tell me stuff about themselves, and I'll ask them their last name, and they'll tell me some narrative that isn't true. Because I'm like, that's not true, because those people only lived on that side of the river, you know. So some Black people got to be careful when they talk to me about, you know, being part Cherokee and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that you ain't really part Cherokee because those people weren't Cherokee. But even with the Cherokee part, like, what's really fascinating that many Black people, most of the clients that I had initially, like maybe the first 15, all wanted me to find their Cherokee ancestor, all of them. And it was always a woman. It was never a man, and she was always, her hair was always so long, she tripped over it. You know, it was the same story. I was like, wow, are you all related to each other? What's going on here? And so, but what I did discover was there is some truth in our sort of Native American ancestry, because of the Southeast had a sizable population of what they call mixed race Cherokee or mixed race Indians by the mid 1700s or the mid 18th century. And so if you had someone like that in your ancestry, say like a fourth great grandmother, and she ends up having 150 to 200 great grandchildren, and those 250 great grandchildren also have grandchildren, all those people can claim that same ancestor and say, oh yes, I'm part Cherokee. So there is some truth to it. You know, it's just, I think people are kind of lost in the narrative at all. Narrative of it all. But my bigger point is, I just became very, very fascinated in helping Black people, Black families sort of find out more about their American experience. Because I think it was often sort of, you know, erased and or not considered urgent or important. We were taught things that were not about ourselves or misinformation about ourselves. We were not taught the micro specificity of who we were in our grandparents and great grandparents' journeys. So for me, it's like really, it's a very revolutionary act to find and build trees for Black families.
And that's how many grandchildren did your grandfather have?
My grandfather had 11 grandchildren.
Why did he tell you?
I don't know.
Of course you know. Why do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't know because, I mean, one thing I was, when my mother went to work, when my parents went to work, my mother dropped me off of my grandparents before I started school. So I was dropped off there and I was around them. And then she would pick me up at 3 o'clock and take me back home. But I spent the day with them. And I think perhaps because I was around them so much, and perhaps I expressed some eagerness and a curiosity about many things. My grandfather probably said, well, here's the one I'm going to store the history within this kid.
Yeah. He was midwifing you to be the next griot, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. But I'm thankful that he did that and very grateful, because I didn't know that as an adult, it would turn into such a significant part of my life. And even, you know, in a way inform my interest in the future, you know, in Afrofuturism and sci-fi, you know, sort of understanding the past helps me, but I think it triggers an urgency about rebuilding a future. And sort of reimagining the future, because I saw what the past looked like in both its ugliness and its beauty. And so like, can I craft something like that for the future? You know? So yeah, it's been a very significant part of my life and I'm very grateful for it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now you also have a show. I mean, I saw the first episode of it, of a kind of sci-fi horror piece, The Abandon. You know, that's my favorite world, the sci-fi horror. Yes. So The Abandon, is there going to be more of The Abandon? And I know you were even having some readings for another sci-fi piece. I wasn't sure if that was an extension of The Abandon or what.
Right. So yeah, The Abandon, I created a few years back, with the intention of it being a full series, like a 6-episode series, like 20 minutes each web series. And, you know, got all the funding I could for that first episode, very much inspired by The Descent, which was a sort of sci-fi horror film from back, I think, like 2008, I believe, about a group.
Is that the women down in the cave?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Yes. You're like, is that
women? Because when I saw that, I didn't even finish it the first time. I was like, look, just these women fighting with each other. That's a horror enough.
Exactly, right. It's such a smart film because it's like you place people together who already have tension. You put them in a secluded, isolated environment, which is for them caves underground. And then you sort of introduce like this other sort of entity that they have to fight. And then that triggers their sort of, you know, survival instincts. And then therefore that triggers their animosity. You know, so it's a great, great sort of very simple way of telling story about character in close relationships, which is what I wanted to do for The Abandon with Black men. I wanted Black men to go on a hiking trip and find themselves in the middle of something, you know, in the case of The Abandon, there was like, you know, a possible alien invasion, alien occupation of the world. And they just happen to be camping while it happens, and it exposes their conflicts and sort of interpersonal sort of demons or whatnot. So the mission of that was to have 6 episodes. And then after the first episode launch, which was very, very successful, like it just went crazy. I was like, wow, this is like people really wanted to see like Black folk in a sci-fi world. Even though when I initially pitched it to an executive, like an industry executive from some major company, Tanya, it was interesting. They told me that, oh, well, that's very interesting, but black people don't watch sci-fi. There's no audience for it. I was like, huh? So that made me go out and do it myself. I was like, you know, so I'm going to do it myself. But what happened was, and it happens often, I believe, I learned such a big lesson in this, is that I had several people come to me wanting to support the project financially. And so they dangled money in my face anywhere. It was anywhere from $50,000 to $1 million dangled in front of me, as far as like, we can make this happen, right? People were coming from out of Facebook, like Facebook messaging me from Hollywood, you know, all that was going on. And I got so amped. I was like, oh my God, this is about to blow up. Oh my God, you know? And so I wrote all the other episodes and I was so excited. And then one by one, each one of those sort of danglings just sort of went away. You know, money didn't come through. They were now not interested. They moved on to something else. So now I'm left with nothing. I'm left with a year and a half later, waiting for monies to happen with, you know, the urgency behind it was gone. So then I wrote a feature version of it, which I think you may be talking about.
Okay.
Feature film version of The Abandoned. I'm still trying to kind of get that made. It's definitely a sample that's being used often. I have a couple people looking at it now. I have another film, though, that is a horror film that another writer, Devin Hawk, and I co-created and wrote. And we are actually, that is going to be produced. We were just on the phone with the producers yesterday about COVID-19. We're calling it COVID-19 proofing the script. Which,
what does that mean?
Means basically like looking in scenes and taking out all the crowd scenes, and sort of downsizing characters so that way you have less characters, less actors sort of to be responsible for the, you know, responsible for their health. And like making sure like, you know, like there's enough outdoor shots and trying to keep anything that's inside a space. Like, can you do it outside the space? You know, things like that. So, but yeah, so that film, which is called The Nightman, it's coming to production soon, I hope. I don't...
Awesome.
We'll see. Yep.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I just made my first feature film in the fall.
Oh, nice.
Which is a socio-political horror film, and we're in post now, and hopefully it'll find a home because content is king at the moment.
Exactly. It's probably for people who have things. Somebody was just saying to me yesterday that it's really a good time for people who have things in post-production because companies are buying. They need content. They need content. You know, I think I even heard that there are people are going, some of the companies and networks are going back into the vault of things that they said no to.
Yeah, I'm sure that's happening.
And pulling that back out. Yep.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to see a lot of stuff that got shelved, a lot of pilots that got shelved. We're going to see a lot of content that got shelved. I'm sure there's millions of things because people are consuming content so rapidly during this time. And this is going to go on for at least another 6 months.
Yep. I agree with you. I agree with you, definitely.
Seem like to be a very spiritual person to me. Can you tell me something that seemed like a bad thing at the time, but it set you up for something good later?
Hmm. That's a very wonderful question. You know, I think about this often. I'm from Ohio, from Southern Ohio, Cincinnati specifically. And Cincinnati was and still is, for the most part, it's improving, but a very ultra-conservative, very sort of strongly Christian in a right-wing kind of way, extremely racist, which sometimes comes out of the conservatism, and a very absolute world where things are black and white. And I grew up in that environment where there was a certain expectation of me because I was just part of the culture of Southern Ohio, right? And my mother was a maverick and progressive, and so was my dad. But my dad, was much more traditional in sort of the way he behaved and sort of like his interests. But he also was a maverick and progressive thinking, and so they both kind of showed me that there was a world outside of Cincinnati where I could sort of define myself. I didn't need to sort of rely on the definitions of an absolute world. And I think, you know, because I was navigating sort of gender expectation and sort of, you know, racism and all those things in Southern Ohio, I began to feel a little suffocated, and I felt like I didn't know myself. I felt like I was walking around with definitions that other people had sort of imposed on me, and I couldn't find myself. And I think that once I left Ohio, sort of with the kick of my mother, like, get out of here, because if I could, I would get out of here, right? That's what she said to me. And got into the world, I really devoted and decided to commit my life when I was relatively young, like in my early 20s, mid-20s, that my life was going to be dedicated to self-definition. And so that required a lot of unpacking of other people's expectations, a lot of other people's insecurities and fears and all of that. And that's a lifetime of work to unpack, you know, just not your sort of immediate experience of growing up in a certain place, but even the generational expectation and traumas that are imposed upon you as a black person, as an American, as a human. And so I think I'm very intentional about always being aware that I have the license to unpack and find myself. And so I feel like every 6 months I'm like, oh my God, I feel like a brand new person, you know, because I'm constantly, you know, finding myself, you know? And I think maybe that, you know, is translatable. That's being translated as a spiritual sort of journey. And I think it is, you know, I feel like I'm always in conversation with the universe, with God all the time. And I thank it for, you know, showing me that self-definition was going to be my salvation, you know?
So with your, you know, ongoing self-defining becoming, what are you saying yes to and what are you saying no to? And how do you find the way to say no?
Yes, God. Well, you know, what's interesting, Tanya, like initially when, you know, the stay-at-home order happened and the pandemic sort of really sort of showed its face, right? And everybody was just like, what, my God, and there was deaths and all that. Like, I really didn't have any, I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. And, you know, and I was also in the middle of like curating some plays for the Apollo Theater and sort of, you know, the New Black Fest was coming up and I had all these very specific things and ideas about what I wanted to do sort of politically and artistically. And then this happened and it just silenced me. And I was like, oh my God, I don't even know what to do. Like, what do you say to this? Like, you know, let me take some time to just be still and just figure out where I am and what is happening to all of us. And out of that came a disinterest in anything that wasn't speaking on the behalf of black well-being. Not interested. No interest for it. I don't want to just have, and then people were inviting me to sort of participate in play readings, virtual play readings. And I was like, well, if the play that is happening has something to do with our wellness and what's happening right now in our current situation, cool. But if it's not, I don't want anything to do with it. That's just where I am right now. Mm-hmm. So even I told my managers, it got to the point I told my manager, hey, I don't want to have any more conversations with producers or any production companies, if the content they're interested in has nothing to do, if it has nothing to do with Black folks or marginalized experience or the current state of the world. Like, and that's where I am now. I think I've always kind of been that way, but I think this, you know, speaking back to what you were saying about what triggered you from one thing to the other, this pandemic has definitely triggered a part of me that has always wanted to stand strong in a certain sort of POV, you know? And now I'm just like, nope, if it ain't got nothing to do with that, I don't want to have anything to do with it. I'm not interested.
And you say that you are busier than you've ever been.
Yes. It's crazy. Yes. So yeah, that's where I am. That's where I am. And now, you know, even now, things are coming to me. Like, you know, I think taking this time and just being still, even though it's difficult, because, you know, like you said, like the COVID-19, the pandemic thing, this could be going another 6 months and beyond. And so I'm aware of that. But now I feel a little more empowered by just being still and looking at the world and looking a little ahead in the future, which is what I always do. Like, I just say, okay, what's going to happen in 2 months, right? And so I'm much more inspired and focused to create work, to participate in conversations about work, you know, and be very specific about, you know, how to curate and engineer things that I think are important to who we are right now. And because, you know, like you and I were just saying earlier, you more than I was in the beginning, like this has really exposed a lot about this pandemic has really exposed a lot about the vulnerability of the Black community in this country, and just historically so.
Mm.
And so what can we do as thinkers, as artists, as human beings to rectify that vulnerability? And that's not to say that we're not empowered people or extremely intelligent, because that's a given, right? That's one of the reasons why they try to keep us vulnerable. But, you know, I think that even more so for me, I want to be much more active and much more deliberate about sort of finding ways to minimize the vulnerability, you know? And that's where I am.
I feel like Ava, Lena, Issa are really, you know, making this space and bringing and midwifing other artists through. Do you see that will continue, you know, post COVID, that they will continue to have these platforms to keep bringing new voices into the television film world?
Yes, I do believe so. I think Ava in particular is interesting because she does seem to be very invested, even though she says she never thought she would sort of be sort of a political filmmaker, but she seems very much invested in those type of stories. And sort of exposing those truths. And I think for me, she is someone that is a beacon as far as like wanting to continue to tell those kind of urgent stories and being sort of committed to that kind of urgency. I think Lena and Issa are continuing to create opportunities which allow for other artists to find their urgency and sort of, you know, be committed to urgency. So all of them are equally sort of important. For different reasons, you know, but I definitely feel like, you know, it's undeniable that our story and experiences in this country are, you know, integral to changing this, you know, the way this country is looked at and how it sort of navigates. I think it's always been us, like you said, it's always been us, you know, as far as the democracy is concerned, like, and I think that even if there is any law that somehow the white institution decides, oh, we want to tell Black stories because we understand what's going on too, which that is also going on, and you and I are aware of that, right? But I think, like you were saying earlier, like the guerrilla sort of movement that is necessary right now because we don't know what's going to happen to the smaller sort of institutions and entities, it's very important that we get on the ground and just unapologetically in your face tell good quality stories about who we are, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because I think it's just what we need, you know? And thankfully we have Ava Issa and Lena and others who are sort of,
Charles King, Macro. Yeah,
right. Exactly. But we also can't wait for all that. You know,
it has been such a pleasure talking to you. I have one last question for you in our COVID-19 edition. What are you consuming, movie, book, television, film that is, you know, what are you nourishing yourself on right now?
I'm consuming television. You know,
tell us what.
Let's see. I've watched Little Fires Everywhere, which I thought was really interesting storytelling and an interesting sort of racial gender conversation. I watched the Malcolm X documentary, which broke my heart and blew my mind.
What's that on?
That's Netflix.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Are you talking about the Miles Davis?
Mm-mm, no, Malcolm X.
Oh, okay. I don't even know that one. Okay.
Yeah. Malcolm X doc.
Okay.
And, what else have I,
what you reading?
You know, I just finished reading N. Jameson's, you know, sci-fi writer's newest novel, which is set in New York.
What's it called?
The City We Became.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which is really, really good. Very inclusive, like inclusive world. Like everybody's represented. It's really kind of wonderful. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. You know, honestly, like I said, like, you know, there's been a lot of time where I'm just sort of still and just sort of chilling. I'm, you know, experimenting with a lot of vegan cuisine, and I done mastered a, you know, oatmeal, almond butter cookie, you know, with no flour, you know, really trying to nourish my spirit, you know, my body, keep myself healthy. And you know, so that's always helpful.
Well, it was really great getting to talk to you, Keith.
You too.
And you sound like you're just blooming.
Oh, I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much. I'm going to wrap out, and we need to stay on the phone for a moment because they have to upload the recording.
Okay.
Because that's the way Zencastr works. So I'm going to just do a close.
Okay.
And then we're going to just wait until Alan tells us that we're done. Thank you so much, Keith, for speaking with me today. This would be a COVID edition of You Can't Say That. My name is Tanya Pinkins. And come back and listen to more intimate conversations with smart people about the world that we live in.
Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins. This is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals. Edited by Derek Gunther. Music by Anthony Norman. Available wherever you get your podcast. And visit me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and let me know what you'd like to hear me talk about. For more information, visit bpn.fm/YCST.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.